So we have been studying in Matthew 23. We've gotten into Matthew 24. I'd like for everybody to turn over there now. And then as you're doing so, though, I found this picture this week. This one's brand new to me. And I was really stunned at how accurately it was done. And so this is not a photograph, of course, of modern Jerusalem, nor can it be an artist's actual painting of something he was looking at from 2,000 years ago. But based on the existing walls, based on what we know from extensive descriptions that you have in the book of Josephus, based on the lay of the land, which Don and I and several others of you have seen, that is the single most accurate representation of what it might look like to be seated on the Mount of Olives and looking out over the city of Jerusalem that I think I've ever found. Now, I've already given you studies at other times on the book, the city and the Temple Mount that is in Jerusalem. And so we've talked about that city before. You've seen actual photographs. I had some up even last Sunday. So you've seen what it really truly is. But I just love this particular photograph, or picture rather, because it fleshes out in very, very accurate detail the towers that they had, that the Romans had built, the temple itself. It looks to have been done very much in scale. So that picture right there gives you just such a great feel for these four disciples coming up to Jesus and asking him while they were on the Mount of Olives about this place, which you can look at just like that. It's this viewpoint that is so accurate and so very clear. Now, Jesus would be on the north end of the Mount of Olives, and he would be, as a matter of fact, getting fairly close even to Mount Scopus, which is just a tiny bit higher than what you see in this photograph right now. But all that means is that wherever Jesus was on this hillside, he might have been even closer to the temple itself. You can see very clearly all the way down to the pavement level that the temple itself stood on. Solomon's portico and the rest of the city spread out over what is Mount Zion. And you remember from our discussions in our last class, that not the last Revelation class, but Sunday night, Zion can be this hill right here or this hill right here. Both are referred to in Scripture. So Jesus was looking out over the entirety of the city of Jerusalem. He was looking right down, most close to him, at the temple and the Temple Mount itself. He was looking out across Mount Zion when the events that we're studying in Matthew chapter 24 took place. Every word that Jesus utters in Matthew chapter 24 takes place while he and the disciples have that exact viewpoint of the city. Now, for quick review, you tell me, where does your study of the book of Revelation begin? Matthew 24. Where does Matthew 24 study begin? Matthew chapter 23. You roll on into the book of Revelation without chapters 23 and chapter 24, I really think you're making a big mistake. I haven't shown you why yet. We will get to that in another couple of 3 weeks probably, but trust me, it's going to bear some fruit for you in a little while. Matthew chapter 23, as we studied last week, Jesus is enraged at these people seven times. He declares that woe will come upon them. He says they'll receive a greater condemnation. They are sons of Gehenna. They are under the sentence of Gehenna. And upon them will fall all the righteous blood shed on earth from Cain to Zechariah. And their house, in verse 38, will be left to them desolate. We'll go over it again this week. Last week I gave you two pages there, filled the whole screen with the criticisms that Jesus had of these people, the horrifying sins that they were committing, the terribly hard hearts that they had. He was unhappy with the scribes and Pharisees because they were hypocrites. He's unhappy with the Jews, who are the blind being led by the blind. He is very unhappy with anybody that is following these various crimes or committing these various crimes or following those men who were teaching both false doctrine and practicing immorality. Spent a lot of time this last week, so when did Jesus say that the woe and the condemnation and the desolation of the house was going to take place? When? It was going to take place, according to verse 36, in that generation. Make certain that you are eminently familiar with Matthew 23 and verse 36 in particular, but particularly starting with verse 33. Let's begin there now. Matthew 23:33. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna? Is the way Jesus ends his manifold condemnation of the scribes and Pharisees, these hypocrites. The point of that rhetorical question is that they cannot escape this sentence. So in 34, therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate, for I say to you, from now on you shall not see me. That means understand, recognize, appreciate, identify as the Son of God. You shall not see me in that sense until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In that passage, verses 33 through 39, after 32 verses of condemnation, you have his summary declaration that they are serpents, a brood of vipers, and they cannot escape the sentence, the condemnation that God has decreed for them. Then, twice, he will stipulate a prophecy of the future, which is at the same time a reason why this condemnation will fall upon them. So the first predictive prophecy in Matthew 23 and 24 is, in verse 34, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. And then again in verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. Twice, Jesus states why it is that this generation is going to be punished. It is because he is going to be sending them inspired teachers, and they will reject, persecute, and in every way abuse, to the point of death, the apostles and the prophets and the others that he will be sending. So, as we saw last week, the people are identified as to who is going to be punished. The reason why they're going to be punished is developed at very great length throughout the whole chapter. But in predictive prophecy, foretelling the future, he adds there that it will be because of the prophets and apostles that they're going to be killing. The when is also given, this generation, and the where is furthermore given, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. So, as I pointed out last week, so far as I know, there is not one dissenting voice in all of religious history, I guess. Everybody understands Matthew chapter 23 to be a prediction of the fall of Jerusalem, which will be fulfilled in that generation, took place exactly like Jesus said in the lifetimes of those people to whom he was speaking. No question about that. Then, shortly later, Jesus walked out of the temple. He's still immediately adjacent to it. When you add up both Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke chapter 21, you get all of these statements that help us to identify whether or not the topic, the subject matter, has changed. It has not. They are talking about the temple that Jesus had just said would be left to them desolate. They are pointing out the temple building. They're exclaiming about how wonderful they are. Jesus says, do you, remember the you pronoun through all these studies, do you not see all these things which they were pointing at and talking about? These things you're looking at, these great buildings, Jesus said, not one stone here shall be left upon another. Well, they've got a very clear picture about the desolation of their house. Not just because they're on the Mount of Olives looking at it, but because Jesus has been very careful to define himself who, when, why, where, and now with not one stone left upon another, the how of the inescapable punishment that would come upon that generation. Hearing all of these things then, the apostles are astonished. They can't believe it. It would be like my predicting that Washington, D.C. would be destroyed, or some other major city would be destroyed, or some temple religious structure was going to be destroyed. You would want to know several things about that event. Now, I introduced you to Tim LaHaye, the author, along with Jerry Jenkins of the Left Behind series. He, along with a different guy, Thomas Ice, wrote this book called Charting the End Times. In the Olivet Discourse chapter, he said in that little line right there, these words. The Olivet Discourse is a response to how many questions? He says three, asked by the disciples. Charting the End Times in the chapter on Matthew chapter 24. I argued at great length last week that that is entirely incorrect. It's really pretty inexcusably incorrect. It is very commonly held and taught. It's an enormously popular idea that the disciples asked three questions. They did not. It's also thought that because they asked three questions, which they never did, that there are two different subjects in view. Everybody sees Matthew 23 the same way. Everybody sees the natural questions that these men would be asking. Everybody knows that that would provoke further discussion, and that it did, and that Matthew 24 begins with that discussion. But because they think they see three questions, they then conclude that there are two different subjects. The near one that will take place in that generation, and the far one, which hasn't happened yet to this day, which is 2,000 years, two millenniums off. So, I went about diagramming the sentence, Matthew 24, verse 3, only to get an email or, somebody noticed, from that most guilty-looking woman back there. See how red her face has turned, the nervous smile. Okay. Say, she points out, I blew it. What's wrong? It's what you get for saying that you're challenging all those English teachers out there, I guess. I was absolutely right, brethren. Normally, that's how you would diagram, a simple sentence. Unless you're dealing with an adverb. And you are in the first part, which is what's going to help me to understand. We'll talk about it afterwards. When that's the case, you don't do it like you normally would. You put the adverb over on the other side, and you move it then so that you put the object first, and then the verb, and the subject becomes that adverbial, if you will. And maybe I'm still not using the terminology correct, but that's how you diagram it when you're using the word when. So, it should actually have looked like this, which doesn't change one word about what I said. Okay, it's still true that there's only two interrogatives. That means there's only two questions. It means that the disciples did not ask three questions. It means that there's only one subject and not two. Everything I said is so. I just want to make sure we get it exactly right. And so actually, it should have looked like this. And then you get your these in there properly. There's your conjunction and. We went through and worked, every step of this last time. And everything now from the what question is exactly the same. Nothing has changed. And so what you've got is a complex sentence. You've got a sentence that's really got three parts, but these three parts revolve around only two questions, when and what. The when question is, when will these things, not some other things, not different things, but these things, that's been so very thoroughly identified in the preceding chapter and verses, that there's no mistaking it. Then you have your first conjunction, so that now there's a second question. The second question is, what will be the sign? The what will be the sign question is in the singular, so this and is not adding a third question. It's not changing the topic. It's not putting about something else. They're not turning away from the temple now and saying, well, we'd like to know when the temple's going to fall, what will be the sign for the fall of the temple, and something totally unrelated, 2,000 years in the future, we'd like to know what about the end of the world. They did not do that. This conjunction ties these phrases together so that the sign of your coming is the sign of the end, and that's when I did my little fancy S right there. Look, I guess I didn't get it all up there. At the end of the age, it does not have plural S on the end of sign. There's only one sign. One sign to go with one event. When will these things happen? The event that they're asking about, and what will be the sign when that will happen? That sign is the time when Jesus comes to end the age. So, that's the way the sentence should have been diagrammed, always will, you know, in the future, unless Faye changes her mind this week. But actually, it drove both Donna and I online. We went back through the grammars again, and I discussed it too with Faye, you know, and realized where I made my mistake here. But anyway, hopefully that straightens all that out. Now, you saw this last week, I think I didn't mention, I put all those garish, ugly, ridiculous questions, colors rather, up there for the purpose of trying to really embed this in your head. There are only two questions. Now, suppose you haven't got a clue how to diagram sentences. And you haven't got Faye to teach you. Okay. Suppose you don't understand any of that. How biblically would you answer the question, does Matthew 24, verse 3, have three questions or only two? How biblically, scripturally, would you answer that question? If you were looking for internal evidence, that is, some statement that's in the Bible to answer the question, does that verse 3 have three questions in it or only two, where would you go to answer the question biblically? You tell me. Louder. Go to Mark chapter 13, or go to Luke chapter 21 and verse 7. I forget the verse, 2 or 3 in Mark. But there, Mark and Luke only know about two questions. Two questions. So, very conclusive. Only two questions. They are when and what, and they revolve around only one sign. One sign, not two. The sign of his coming is the sign of the end. Now, since there's only one subject, and that subject is the end of the age, we've got really only one more big thing to try to figure out what the chapter's talking about. I did this somewhat last week. I've done a little bit in the Bolton articles too, I guess, but I want to talk about Matthew 24:3 now. So everybody, we read the last part of 23. Let's go to chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus came out from the temple, was going away, when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. He answered and said to them, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another, which will not be torn down. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming, and of the age of the end of the what? The end of the age. We'll dislike it here tonight. Okay, so in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3, what does that word mean? Get your pencils out. Make sure you're taking notes. This is something that you're going to want to be able to remember. So, that's the Greek word. That's the way it looks in Greek. The word for age is aionos. It would sound like aionos. Okay. Yeah, perhaps you know the Greek. If you're going to then transliterate in each of the Greek letters an equivalently sounding English letter, the English transliteration, what it sounds like, is this. Aionos. That's how you pronounce it in English. The word in English that is not a direct translation, but is derived from it. You could translate it this way. I'm not opposed to translating it this way. But what I'm trying to show is that this aionos or eonos is eon. And so our word, spelled only slightly differently, but sounding very similar for eon, carries the same idea too, because it was derived from that word. Our Greek word comes from the original, our English word comes from the original Greek word. And then finally, if you're going to give it the verbal equivalent, the actual translation, the best word to use would be age. Age. The end of the age. So I did everything to set my hair on fire last week, you know, telling you that the King James Version that has world instead of age is incorrect, wrong, and needs to be fixed. And that's a pretty bold statement, I know that. A lot of people still really love that King James Version, but they erred in 1611 when they translated it world. It doesn't mean world, it means age. To quote from one Greek lexicon, it means period of time, age, eon, or they even added human lifetime. It is a time reference, not a substance reference, not an object reference, not a thing reference. It is a time reference. It means age. The idea is eon. Sounds like ionos. That's what you get. It is not, it is absolutely not the word cosmos. There's your Greek letters. Cosmos might much more fairly and accurately be translated world or planet. Really, at its root, means orderly arrangement, what it really means. And so this universe being so orderly arranged, arranged so orderly, we have, then, you know, that word cosmos, to speak of it. If you wanted to address a universe or a solar system or the planet, that's the word that you would use much more likely. There's another word, date, and I messed this up. There should be an eta in there, and I'll show you one in a minute, but that word I missed a letter on. But date is translated earth or dirt or soil or land. We'll spend quite a bit more time on this later. So don't worry so much about that. I just want you to know there are other words. But this other word, gase, it would be spelled like G-A-S-E, that word, yes, you can translate it earth. But if you translate it earth, it's really seldom, if ever, carrying the idea of globe or planet, like we attach to our English word, earth. This is really different than that. So when you say earth, it's earth in the sense of, I was digging in the earth, and I uncovered an earthworm. Okay? I mean, a dirtworm. So, you know, it's not global. It means dirt. It means soil. And frequently, and maybe most often, is translated land. We'll get to that, as I say, in further studies. But I want you to see this third word now is oikoumene. There's your A. That should have been one in between right there. But oikoumene is another word that can mean world or earth, or could be translated world or earth. See, our problem here, brethren, is we've got four different Greek words. Now, they're different Greek words. And like in English, you can have some overlapping definitions, you can have some similarities. There's really only one reason why we have different words. So we can have different ideas attached to those words and distinguish them somehow. So these three words, which might be translated any one of these ways, does not appear in Matthew 24, verse 3. The word that does appear is ionos, eon, or age. Now then, having established how many questions there are, two, about one subject, when will the temple be destroyed? When will the house be left desolate? And what will be the sign when, Jesus, you're coming to end that age, the Jewish age, the Mosaic age? If you take away the Jews' temple, brethren, what have you taken away from the Jews? Everything. You have taken away the presence of God, first and foremost. You have taken away their whole sacrificial system. You have taken away their main treasury as well, but you have taken away what is a theocracy. A theocracy means what?
Quick definition.
Theocracy. Where the government is what kind of a government? Secular or religious? It's a religious government. So their political figures were religious figures as well, associated, tied to the temple. Take away the temple. And brethren, that which makes a Jew, in the sense of their government and their religion, has just been annihilated. Sure, they still have their genealogies, you know, yeah, the men will have a sign of circumcision, they're still living in the area, but you take it away, and they cannot practice that which separates them from the Gentile world insofar as their relationship with God goes, the temple. Now, in verses 3 through 13, we're going to go very quickly, because Jesus will tell us now what the sign is not. There are two questions. When will these things be, and what will be the sign? He will answer the sign question first, and he'll answer it in the negative. He will first tell them what the sign is not. He will then tell them when, and then he will tell them what the sign is. That's the next order for verses 4 through 15. But in verses 3 through 13, that whole section is what the sign is not. So you scan down now, and I'll just put them up on the screen here. But Jesus answered, and he said, "See to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying I am the Christ, and will mislead many. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time, many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold." There's your list of the signs. How do I say this? There's the list of what the sign is not. As to what the signs aren't, I guess. Okay? So when you hear, you know, these false Christs, is that the end? No, that's not the end. You're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars. Is that the end? No, that's not the end. You're going to hear about famines and there's going to be earthquakes. Is that the end? No, that's not it. There'll be tribulation, murder, and hated by everybody. Well, that's it. No, that's not it. Apostasy, betrayal, and more hatred. Many false prophets and all kinds of deception. In these verses, you don't know. He doesn't know. He says, all this is going to go down, and don't be upset when you see it. Because that's not it. That's first, but that's not the sign of the end. That's the beginning, not the end. Brother, this is very interesting. Very, very interesting. In light of a pronoun that seems to be just almost universally ignored. Y-O-U spells what? You. Now, Jesus is sitting there looking at the men who had been pointing at the temple, extolling, you know, how beautiful it was, and were astonished at the idea that the house could be left desolate. With all of that going on, they want to know what the sign is. Jesus says, it's not these things that you will need to worry about. You. Who's the you? Who is he talking to? Them. And did he not say they would see these things? Does that not root everything back into the first century? So, when Helen G. and anybody else, they go, oh my, all kinds of guys, you know, some young moon is claiming to be a Christ and all that. That's going on right now. And there's more wars than ever we've seen in the world before. There's famine in Ethiopia and Bangladesh and earthquakes. Woo! So many earthquakes. Why, we've never had earthquakes like this before. And look, you can read in your newspaper that these are the signs of the end, and it's upon us any day now. This is it. And what did Jesus say? This is not it. What do they say? This is it. Jesus says, no, it isn't. And they say, yes, it is. Jesus says, no, it's not. Now, brother, that's a fundamental problem, isn't it? With all this furor we have in our last days madness, remember the book I recommended, everybody trying to see the fulfillment, the answer to the question in verse 3 in their newspapers today, 2 millenniums later. This is so wrong. Jesus couldn't be any clearer. The people he is talking to will see these things. They will see these things. And when they see these things in their lifetime, that's not the end. That's the beginning of the end. So this also tells us, brethren, that an amount of time is going to go by that they will see large enough to embrace many false Christs, wars as plural, rumors of wars is plural. And please bear in mind, brethren, news didn't travel instantaneously at the speed of your broadband width, you know, like it does today. So it takes a lot of time to go by and then to get, you know, news of this kind. Tribulation, murder, hatred, apostasy has to take place. Betrayal and hatred, and many false prophets we come back in. It's a lot going to go down, but they're going to see it. So a picture develops in our minds of how much time is going to go by. Well, it's not more than one generation, is it? Because they'll see it. And it'll all happen in this generation. But, you know, it's going to take a while. It'll take a generation. It's going to be some time involved here. Now, remember in Matthew 24, 3 through 13, here's what they should not do. They should not be misled. They should not be frightened. This is just the beginning. In verses 4, 6, and 8, respectively. And then they are told what they should do in verse 13. The one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. He shall be what? Saved. Now, brother, like the word baptism, what does baptize mean? Immerse or dip or bury or plunge or submerge. You know, and all these words are appropriate. Okay? Now, that word refers exclusively, never to anything else, always and only to a religious ceremony by which we are born again. Right? No, it just means dip or plunge. And so it depends on the context of what you're talking about. You might be dipping or plunging in the Old Testament a priest's finger into blood so he could sprinkle on people. It might be dipping hyssop into that blood to sprinkle on people. It could be any number of different things. And so, if we take a word that means immerse, and then we turn it into a formal term that can only refer to one thing, we're missing the whole point everywhere else in the Bible where it's not used that way. Brother, we have exactly the same thing going on here. What does the word saved me? Raise your hand if you have a savings account. Maybe that'd be embarrassing. You don't. Are you saving money? You tell us you should. I haven't been very successful at it. You know you're supposed to. Okay. Do you save remnants of fabric? Sure. How often do you use the word save? Save me from the Tim LaHaye of the world. What do I mean? Am I talking about sin, being saved from sin? No, not in that context. All it says is, you'll be saved. so they're looking at all these things that they're going to endure. I guess I should go back to the previous, you know, slide. But if we're looking at all the stuff that they're going to endure, could you have a problem with war and not surviving it? Could you have a problem with a famine and not survive it? Do people need to be saved from earthquakes? Do they need to be saved from tribulation? Do you want to be saved from murder? Okay? I don't want to be saved from all these things. But sin isn't in the list anywhere, is it? Is this a theological discussion about redemption at the end of the world? Whether or not you're going to go to heaven? Is that what we're talking about? Was that question a part of verse 3? No. Brethren, it can't be more specific, I don't think. They're pointing, they're talking. Jesus says, you see here, not one stone. It can't be more plain. What they're talking about, then you are going to see all these things. But if you endure to the end, now this will be an interesting question for you. Endure to the end of what? The end of the age is their question, isn't it? If you endure to the end of the age, you shall be saved. Saved how? Saved from what? The first teacher who presented this material to me, and I embraced it wholeheartedly, and I've never deviated from it, since 1975, said something in 1975 I'll never forget. He said, brethren, what we're talking about in verse 13 is salvation of skin, not salvation from sin. It's easy to remember, isn't it? We're talking about saving your life, not being killed by a war or a famine or an earthquake or the tribulation or murder, all these things. To be saved physically, you're going to endure a lot. Endure the end, and you will be saved. Now, I don't think I've really proved that yet. You might say, well, I think he's talking about the end of the world, and so he's saved eternally, and it has to do, you know, the spiritual idea, not a physical one, and all that. So we'll revisit this question as we go along. But up to this point, brethren, let me just ask you in your subsequent readings, you're going to read this a lot in the weeks to come, I hope. Try to find sin in there. Try to find redemption in there. Try to find the sacrifice of Christ in there. Try to find, you know, anything in there that would make you think in terms of a spiritual salvation when everything they're talking about is very, very physical. So, what they should not do is be misled, frightened. It's just the beginning. They need to endure to the end so that they'll be saved. We'll come back to that in a little while. Now, let's talk about some time references here for a minute. And again, this, I think, really helpful if you get your pens and pencils out, you know, and write in your Bible, especially, this time. In Matthew 24, the word you will be used 28 times. 28 times. Who is Jesus talking to? We have always striven in churches of Christ to be a people of the book. We're rather proud of that. We're not interested in the Pope's books. We're not interested in Martin Luther's catechism. We're not interested in the Baptist manual or the Methodist discipline. We're only interested in the Bible. And so we're very proud of the questions, who, what, where, when, why, and how. We're very proud of saying to people, I think rightly so, not probably in a poor sense, but you know, it's our fundamental goal in life to be studying the Bible, asking ourselves these questions, who, what, where, when, why, and how. Those are only interrogatives that exist in the English language, unless you want to add whom, and you should. Who is speaking and to whom are they speaking is really two questions. So who and whom then? But he says, you, and you got 12 men on a hillside looking down at what they've been pointing at, and Jesus is talking to them, and he says, you, do you suppose they're going, boy, glad we're going to miss that one, but 2,000 years from now, those guys are going to be in trouble. Would they maybe get the idea that he was talking to them if he said you? He just might. We at least ought to put that on the table as a possibility that perhaps it involves them, the question askers. all these things shall come upon this generation. Jesus had said in 23:36. As a time reference, you can be pretty specific to the people he's talking to. And as another one, that means your lifetime, all these things shall come upon this generation. There's a time reference that's pretty hard to escape. And nobody does in Matthew 23. This gospel shall be preached in the whole oikoumene. Please look at verse 14. After these verses, 4 through 13, we're at 12, where he tells you what the sign is not, and then tells you what you ought to do is endure to the end to be saved, he will, in one very short sentence, answer the when question as directly as can be answered. The one who endures to the end shall be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. You got your pencils? The words for world is oikoumene. It's not ionos. It's not cosmos. It's not gates. It's oikoumene here. Now, brethren, truly, I spent 5 years college level, both beginning and intermediate Greek studies. Nobody has to do that. Thanks to all the computers and all the help we got now, you know, you can get around in the Greek a whole lot easier. I spent 5 years. Very seldom do I say to anybody ever, here's a case where it's quite helpful to know the Greek. But I've already done it with age. And now I'm going to do it again with this word world, oikoumene. You need to know the difference in an eon or an oikoumene. So, let's think about this oikoumene a little bit. Because when the gospel is preached in all of it, then, what was their first question? When was the answer? Gospel preached in the whole oikoumene, whatever they would get out of that word, and then the end shall come. Not all that other stuff. It'll come when this is done. Matthew 24, verse 14. So in your Bible, you ought to write this verse 14, maybe a big when, or when answered, you know, something. So you know, from verse 3, the when answer is right there in verse 14. Okay? Now, let's talk about this a little bit. What is an oikoumene? Says, brethren, this is a fascinating word study. It's also a really important one. And it just doesn't come out in English at all. In the Greek of the first century, there was quite a distinction that's being made here. Now, you've all heard about Josephus. I've counted him quite a bit. First century Jew, born about the same year that Jesus died, eyewitness to the fall of Jerusalem, a Pharisee and a general. He is as first century, you know, biblical kind of a Jew as you're ever going to meet, and one of the world's most accurate, I think, and also prolific historians. In 66 A.D., he heard a speech by Herod Agrippa addressing the Jews, who by this time were already contained inside the city of Jerusalem, pleading with them to give up, because Rome was vastly more powerful. There was no hope that they could withstand the Roman assault. So he's pleading with them to surrender. They won't for another 3 years, but he tried. Here's what he said. Will you shut your eyes to the might of the Roman Empire and refuse to take the measure of your own impotence? Have not our forces been beaten even by our neighbors again and again, while their arms have been invincible over the whole oikoumene? Nay, they even desired for more than this oikoumene. For not content with having the Euphrates as their frontier in the east, the Ister in the north, Libya explored into desert regions in the south, or Gades in the west, they have sought a new oikoumene beyond the ocean and carried their arms as far as Britain, unknown previously to history. Now, I always like to brag right here. There's only really, I think, been one time in my 40 years of Bible study where I had an aha moment and I can say, huh, I figured that out on my own. Teacher
teachers are for. People help me to understand all of this.
But this one, brethren, I found all on my own. I got to wondering about what a first century Jew would make of the word oikumene. So I have several copies of Josephus, and I have a three-volume set that's in the original Greek. So I went to the original Greek, and then I looked up every use of oikumene in the Greek text of Josephus' Wars of the Jews. And I found that passage. Now let's analyze it a little bit. Because I just about, you know, got arrested for hysteria the moment that I saw this. Then I realized what it meant. The quote comes from Wars of the Jews, Book 2, Chapter 16, Paragraph 4. Now, break it down. First he said he was talking about the might of the Roman Empire. That's not the word oikumene. He said Roman Empire there. Then he said, their arms have been invincible over the whole oikumene. Had Roman arms been invincible over Antarctica? Had Roman arms been invincible in Borneo, Philippines, China? They didn't go to these places, brethren. Roman arms were only invincible over the oikumene, whatever that is. Nay, they even desired for more than this oikumene. You could have more than one oikumene. And the Romans had theirs. And then they decided they wanted more. They wanted another oikumene. They wanted to expand their oikumene. They wanted their oikumene to be bigger. Then he gives you the 4 points of the compass definition, the perimeter of the oikumene. He says, the Euphrates is the frontier in the east. He then says the Ister, which is our Danube today, in the north, which is where Germany, Austria, Slovakia, Hungary, Croatia, Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine, Moldova, are all on that river. And then he said Libya in the south, and Gades, which is their word for Spain, in the west. Then he said they've sought a new oikumene beyond the ocean, carried their arms as far as, I forgot the far as Britain, unknown previously to history. Whoops, missed that. Unknown previously to history. Brethren, the oikumene is defined by a first century Jew speaking the same language Jesus did and speaking it in 70, 71, 72 A.D. as he was first an eyewitness and then composing his history. And as he's doing this, he says, that's the oikumene. This gospel will be preached in that, and then what comes? Then the end will come. Did he say the gospel would be preached in the whole planet? Not if you're a first century Jew. Now starting with Hal Lindsey in 1973, when I first read Late Great Planet Earth, he was going on about how, you know, translations every day are getting into new countries, and pretty soon we'll have the whole world covered. You've heard lots of guys, you know, these televangelists, send me your money, send me your money, send me your money, and I'm going to do a translation, might be the last one. And then the gospel will have been preached in the whole world, so the end can come. They're all of them just as wrong can be. And here's another way they're wrong. Now, I just gave you external biblical evidence. Remember, the external evidence in Revelation favors the late date, the internal evidence favors the early. We've been talking now about external evidence in Josephus about this question in Matthew as well. Here's internal evidence, brethren. In Luke 2, verses 1 and 2, in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census should be taken of the whole planet. Right or wrong? How much control did he have over the whole planet? But he had control over the what? The Roman Empire. It's translated inhabited earth. The word is oikumene. Oikumene. This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. You know exactly what time frame it was that oikumene existed. So if you're thinking into the world, because of the last word, verse 3, you've missed the whole point of the disciples' question. It's not the end of the world. It's the end of the age. And if you're thinking in the answer that the end will come when the gospel is preached in the whole planet, you don't understand at all what they said or what they asked. How Jesus answered. In Matthew 24:14, when the end shall come, we'll close our class tonight. with a series of verses that I gave you recently in the bulletin. Acts chapter 2. The end shall come when the gospel is preached to the entire oikoumene. When was the gospel preached to the entire oikoumene? Well, here's a clue in Acts chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. In Acts 2, verse 5, there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every what? That's a big, fur place. I don't think there were too many in Borneo or, you know, in Antarctica. When this sound occurred, the multitude came together, were bewildered, because they were each one hearing them speak in his own language. And they were amazed and marveled, saying, why are not all those who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we each hear them in our own language, to which we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, districts of Libya around Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them in our own tongue speaking the mighty deeds of God. Oh, well, what do you know? All within the boundaries of the Oikoumene, over which Caesar Augustus had control, and Josephus said was bordered 4 points of the compass, and Britain was outside. Okay? Brethren, there's a lot of territory represented here that the first time the gospel was ever preached, they had come from these places, heard that message, saw miracles, and then went home and forgot all about it and never told a soul, right? Huh? I think he went out into all the oikoumene, don't you? How about Romans 1:8? Much more specifically, since oikoumene does not exist in Acts 2:5, that's why I said it's more like a clue. Let's come over to Romans chapter 1 in verse 8. In Romans 1, first I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. Now this is curious, brethren, because you know what? That is the word cosmos. Whatever you make out of it, it is the word cosmos. Even if you thought there were three questions, even if you thought Jesus was talking about the end of the planet, he said the end would come when the gospel was preached in the whole oikoumene. But they're thinking world, cosmos. And then here it is, cosmos. So the end of the world should have happened back then. Romans was written in 57 A.D. So however you understand these terms, watch this, brethren. A lot of terms are going to be used. Look at Romans 10 now. In Romans 10 and verse 18. In Romans chapter 10, I say, surely they've never heard, have they? Indeed they have. Their voice has gone out into all of the gates, and their words to the ends of the oikoumene. Cosmos, Gaze, and Oikoumene. All of them now, we are told, the gospel's gone into. Skip on down to Colossians chapter 1. The first chapter of Colossians will have two separate passages, as you see on the screen. The first one there is a little bit convoluted, but because of the hope, we're breaking in the middle of a sentence, verse 5, but because of the hope laid up for you in heaven, of which you previously heard in the whole word, in the word of truth, the gospel, which has come to you, just as in all the cosmos, it's not the actual form, it's cosmo, but it's the root word, also it is constantly bearing fruit, increasing, even as it has been doing in you also since the day you heard of it and understood the grace of God and truth. Skip to verse 21. Although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death, in order to present you before him holy and blameless and beyond reproach, if, indeed, you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed, try this one out, in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a minister. Well, that's not eon, cosmos, Gaze or oikoumene. It's all creation under heaven. Now, brother, look. Maybe it did go across the entire surface of the planet. Or maybe these words were being used accommodatively because, clearly, the Roman Empire is all we're talking about. I think he used every single conceivable word to priests by 57 A.D. for the Roman letter, or 62 when the Colossian letter was written, he used every conceivable way to say, Matthew 24:14 has been fulfilled. And then, what should you look for? And then, the end will come. Then, the end of what? The Jewish age. The Mosaic age. The First Covenant age. The desolation of the temple. The end of the entire Mosaic system's ability to function. That age came to an end. But if you endure all these things, you're faithful unto the end, you'll be saved. We'll find out how next week when he answers the what question in verse 15. Thank you.